very warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This series is entitled Back in Time. In these episodes, we shall be discussing the broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various fields are really significant in the exploration of the past. Before I introduce today's very welcome guest, I should mention that this program is being recorded on Zoom, so if you do hear a few background noises, you'll know why. So helping us in our explorations today is Professor Timmy Gambin. Professor Gambin is Associate Professor at the Department of Classics and Archaeology, University of Malta, and is a maritime archaeologist whose interests span ancient Punic ships to ditched World War II aeroplanes. Welcome and thank you, Professor Gambin, for accepting to come on the program to talk to us.
My pleasure, and thank you for having me, Trish.
Right, so let's strike on with my first query. Lots and lots to say. Perhaps it would be best to define maritime archaeology a little bit so that we can start to understand and perhaps visualize a little bit its meaning.
Okay, and the simplest way to define maritime archaeology is to define the two words separately. So I see archaeology as the study of the human past through material remains. And if one looks up the definition of maritime, it is anything related to the sea and seafaring. So whoever studies maritime archaeology studies material remains that are born out of this human relationship with the sea, be it for work, such as trade, for example, and the remnants of trade, the physical remnants of trade, or pleasure, such as seaside villas from the Roman period. So that's a very, very broad sort of canvas with which people in our field can explore the human past.
It is a very broad field, as you say, and is sometimes divided into various sections, but perhaps we can deal with that a bit later.
To clarify, there is a misconception that all maritime archaeology is underwater and all underwater archaeology is maritime, and this is not the case. Just to quickly clarify, just in case our listeners are getting somewhat confused, you could have archaeology that's done underwater, for example, in cenotes or in flooded quarries or other areas that have nothing to do with the sea. The underwater archaeology that's done in central Mexico, for example, in flooded caves, is archaeology done underwater because they're exploring the human past through material remains, but it's got nothing to do with maritime activity. In fact, it couldn't be further away from the sea. It's in the middle of the jungle. And likewise, some maritime archaeology sites, such as warehouses, for example, can be on land and not underwater at all. So again, you're absolutely right in saying that, you know, there are other sub-disciplines and so on, but I hope that clarified for our listeners.
I mentioned in the introduction that you're interested in both ancient and much more modern areas of the field. This shows that really maritime archaeology is useful over millennia. Perhaps you could talk about the way in which maritime archaeology is a discipline that can be adapted for wide-ranging time periods and situations.
The sort of expanded interest locally and personally stems from us being sort of a small nation. Somewhere like France, you have an individual that's specialized in the archaeology of World War I, World War II, and somebody else who's specialized in the archaeology or the maritime archaeology of the ancient world. In fact, numerous people here, we don't have that luxury, so we need to dabble in a bit of everything, really. And that's not a complaint. The techniques used for our discipline can be used to record an ancient site, you know, such as the techniques that we use to record the Phoenician site or the Punic shipwreck that we just started earlier this year, actually. But you can apply those same techniques to recording of modern or let's say recent archaeology. We have to always start with the premise that our law states that everything that is 50 years or older underwater is to be considered as cultural heritage. Now, the aims of, or what one does with, once we have recorded the site, could be two totally different things. With an ancient site, yes, you are recording it for posterity's sake, but then there are research avenues such as cargoes, trade networks, etc. With more recent sites, the focus could well be on, for example, heritage management. What do we do with a large metal wreck that's in our waters? Do we open it up for the public? Is it under threat? Is it a threat to the public, to divers, if we do open it up? And the information that we gather feeds into that kind of stream. So, yes, we use the same techniques, but sometimes to reach different goals, Trish.
You're talking about the different reasons for which a ship or there might be a site underwater. So many different reasons for them being there. Very often, I suppose, it's bad weather that has sunk things. But obviously, in the case of the World War II planes, that they were probably shot down.
There's positives and negatives for, you know, ancient sites or older sites and modern sites. The, let's say, negatives in single inverted commas is that we'll never really know why an ancient ship sunk. I mean, unless there is something very obvious, like it's just off a reef, for example, then one can assume that it hit the reef and sunk, not necessarily in bad weather. It could be bad seamanship or just, you know, a moment of distraction. You know, humans weren't any different then than they are now. Other reasons could be that, you know, ships were scuttled for defense purposes. So, you know, scuttled in order to protect the entry to a port in case of attack. With regard to modern sites, again, or more recent sites, sometimes we have the actual details. So not just, you know, we don't just have the material remains, but we have the full human story. We've got the name of the individual. You know, in one particular case for a plane of Malta, we have his photo album. We've been in touch with his family. So there are obviously different satisfactions that one gets working on different sites. But I can say that they're both equally important and they both equally merit exploration, study and protection.
The word archaeology summons up, I imagine, in most people's minds, the idea of excavation, that kind of physical inquiry. But much of your work is, I believe, well, at least initially, about surveying sites and assessing archaeological potential. And this relates also to the philosophy of archaeology and ethical considerations. I've listened to your talks in the past over the years, and there's always this mix of, we've got this site, but it's beautiful, we found it, but how do we approach the underwater excavation? And there's so many issues involved with that, both physical ones, of course, but also ethical ones.
The first question is sort of, we ask ourselves, is whether we excavate at all. Because it's quite the, I mean, it's the same as sort of terrestrial sites. What do? We know that we have a number of unexcavated sites. Do we take a decision and excavate all of them in, you know, 2022, 2023? And I'm not here to give a yes or no answer, but with a question like that come many perspectives, points of view that can differ from individual to individual, but also such a decision would have to be made on serious aspects such as capacity. Do we have the human resources to do it? Do we have the conservation to do it? Do we have the storage facilities? Are we leaving anything you know, a legacy for future generations to cut their archaeological teeth on, you know, in educational excavations, etc. I need to take a step back because the first part of your question is very important, because people believe, and I think there's a school of thought that believe, that for something to be archaeology, it has to be dug up. But more recently, we've seen aspects such as the archaeology of standing buildings, for example. There's also a whole avenue of archaeology that involves field walking, so no excavation at all, but just, you know, literally walking fields, which is more or less the equivalent of what we do with our sonar, and seeing where there are concentrations of pottery and other you know, human markers for human activity. And I think that is an essential approach, because at the risk of sort of sounding like a stuck record, I don't believe that good decisions related to anything really in life can be taken without the right information. So if one is basing one's decisions on haphazard information, I don't know, we found a site here, therefore let's excavate, then you may be missing something that's, you know, 500 meters away and might render, you know, might give you more value for money, so to speak, or rather to use crude business terms, when it comes to archaeological information, training opportunities, and so on. So that is why I consistently preach that we need to get as much information as possible in order to take informed decisions. This doesn't mean, Trish, that we have to wait until the very end of this grand project of collecting information, because the more time goes on, the more information we have, the more informed decisions we can take. In fact, to answer the last part of your question, which is sort of related to, yes, we found these sites, they're very nice, etc., what do we do? We can now look back and see that we're doing a number of things. And when I say we, I mean we as a nation, University of Malta, Heritage Malta, the superintendents, volunteers, dive clubs. And what is it that we are doing? We are, first and foremost, we've come up with three words at the University of Malta Maritime Archaeology Program, which is explore, record, and share. So explore covers the area where we go out and we survey large tracts of seabed to find sites. Record is, you know, we then see what resources we have available and we start recording by use of remote operated vehicles or deep dive, technical divers, etc. And then share. And share takes on, again, a whole new perspective. We share through the online museum, underwatermalta.org. We share through outreach programs. We've got an outreach program which hopefully with the situation will still be able to go ahead once the current COVID situation calms down, whereby we go around different venues and share our sites with 360 video through the use of headsets, outreach programs at schools, exhibitions, public talks, occasions such as this, for which we're very grateful. So those three words, I think, cover most aspects of our work.
Regarding the ethical issues, again, just like to sort of go a little bit deeper into that, when you do find a site, the issues involved with, do we touch it? I suppose after finding as much information as you possibly can about the particular site, there comes a moment when you have to make that decision. And what is it based? Is it based on, is this going to give us information that is really valuable to archaeology, to the field in general? What are those basic principles that you use to make that decision?
Okay. So to make these decisions, we're now lucky and privileged that earlier this year, Malta ratified the UNESCO Convention for the Protection of Underwater Cultural Heritage. And this convention provides guidelines that are also contained in our law, but now they're framed within this international convention. And one of the first concepts is preservation in situ. So as first option. Now, this doesn't mean that you can't touch anything, but if you can preserve something in situ as first option and record it and share it, etc., then that is the kind of preferred way forward. However, UNESCO itself admits that this is not, and actually sort of propounds this point of view, that it's not always possible to follow this principle of in situ preservation. First and foremost, there are certain objects, such as planes, for example, and metal wrecks, for which the principle of preservation in situ is an oxymoron, because these metal sites are dwindling by the year. You know, you just have to look at Titanic when it was found, you know, more than a couple of decades ago, to Titanic now. It's literally collapsing and being eaten by the ocean, so to speak. So we use these principles to guide us, but there are other aspects. One, are the objects that you're intending to lift, or the site itself, in danger of looting? If there's a site with some loose objects, then a decision may be taken to leave the main site on its own. We know that context is everything. After recording, then we lift these objects with a conservation plan, and ideally, Trish, ideally with a plan for display. Now, display can be either physical, so there is a place waiting for this object as part of a museum story, or the object is scanned and then displayed digitally, either through the museum or through other social media outlets. Secondly, it could well be that one of the objects is of immense importance. So, in fact, so important that, you know, it could crack, let's say we find a late medieval wreck or a wreck from the 9th century or an archaeological deposit from the 9th century. There's so much historical information that we can get from that deposit, for example, that it's worth, you know, every minute spent excavating that site. It would be worth, in my opinion, because that's sort of one of the question marks regarding our history and our archaeology. So just to conclude this answer, there's never a straightforward answer, because there's other aspects. So is the site a war grave, for example? And when is a site a war grave and not a war grave? Is something from World War I a war grave, and then something from the 19th century not, for example? So we do have systems, Trish. We have systems that we run through as much information as we can through them, and we score the sites and so on. And this is hopefully for another invitation, because this is very long and relatively complex process, actually.
Yes, fine. I hope there will be another occasion. I'm hoping the series might be developed a little bit. You were talking about sharing. I know that you take that very seriously, and as I was saying before, I've attended myself lectures where you've told us about what you're doing. But sharing can also be a bit dangerous. You've mentioned looting. I know that it's not that easy to get down underwater in a wreck like the one, the Punic wreck, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's pretty deep, and it's not something people are going to snorkel and see. But there is a danger of things being lost to people. You have to share, but not share too much.
Yes, and that's always sort of the million-dollar question. You know, do we try and keep things secret, or do we shout from the rooftops, or is there a middle road? I personally feel, and I was having a chat with our friend and colleague Ruben Dream, and he agrees that we've reached now a stage of critical mass when it comes to underwater archaeology, that keeping quiet is not going to work anymore. So I think one of our main responsibilities, when I say ours as a society with regard to maritime archaeology, is that we work, and using occasions and programs such as this as well, to elevate the importance of underwater cultural heritage to levels that are similar to those that we see towards land, you know, towards terrestrial sites, or rather the attitude that we have towards some terrestrial sites. Ideally, the starting point will be that people on the streets do not differentiate between cultural heritage that is on land and cultural heritage that is underwater. The two have to be given equal importance. And slowly but surely, we're getting there. We still have a long way to go, but we will get there. The other thing that I find very, very important, Trish, is education. So by educating the general public, and by educating, I mean sharing and telling them what it is we have, why we have what we do have, what is the contribution of these remains to our identity, to our economy as well. Because if you're opening them up for technical divers, then dive schools, you know, have a new market to tap into, as do dive boats, for example. Our museums, then you have the sort of the positive fallout whereby people will visit a site and then they choose to visit the War Museum or the Maritime Museum. Its impact on the university's venture into education and maritime archaeology. We run a very strong MA, Masters in Global Maritime Archaeology. It's been going now since 2016. We're newcomers, but it seems that slowly but surely, again, we are evolving into an important player in the international field. So once the people start to recognize that, I think attitudes will change. They already have started to change. One thing that we started in 2020 is collaboration with dive clubs, and the dive clubs have joined us to start cleaning some of the historic sites from ghost fishing nets, which obviously has a double benefit: is we're improving the experience of the site by removing alien things such as fishing nets. But two, we're also removing marine litter and preventing ghost fishing. And this is happening not just the authorities that are doing this, but the authorities together with individuals, you know, who form part of local dive clubs. And I think this is sort of a very good working example of how things can continue to move forward.
Sort of a slogan of collaboration to create awareness, really, in a broad sense.
Yes, awareness of the sites themselves. So this is the variety of sites we have, but also what the sites mean to us. I mean, this is an example I also use quite often. What is the value of the Maltese Lutsu to Malta? Now, we can calculate the value on the market value of each Lutsu and say all the wood, all the traditional boats in Malta have a value of whatever, you know, €500,000, for example. But that's not what I mean. I go beyond that. What is the added value that the Maltese Lutsu has still gives us with regard to marketing? How many posters of the Malta Tourism Authority have had the eye? How many postcards have been sent throughout the years? Nowadays, it's not postcards, obviously. It's TikTok, Instagram. How many of these posts from people visiting Malta contain images of our Lutsu? So now you have an intrinsic value. The value is no longer the monetary value of the boat itself, but the value it gives a place like Marsa Shlok or Imjar in Gozo, whereby people go there because of the variety of colors and the pretty boats. But then when they're there, they also eat at restaurants and have a coffee and buy souvenirs. And there's the marketing aspect as well. There are actual ways of calculating sort of the marketing clout of something like, or the intrinsic marketing value of something like the Lutsu. So in a way, the simple, humble Lutsu may not seem important, you know, other than to its owner and fisherman. But if we look at it in this way, this hidden value, then all of a sudden the value of the Lutsu goes up exponentially, and therefore its protection, its management, incentives to owners, etc., should be improved at the same rate, or you know, as or rather with this value in mind.
Quite so. In the last literally few minutes that we have, I've always been fascinated by how you actually approach these cultural assets under the sea. And I've watched you on film, you and your team, from the original surveying, going backwards and forwards, like you're saying, the field, like field walking, but with technology, of course, and the difficulties of actually going down deep, you know, having to wait to come up again. It's something that is very energy expensive.
That's a very good point. It's sort of energy draining, not just when you're on the field, but also before. We've been planning now for weeks for a couple of sort of deep projects that we have this coming year in 2022. And besides, even if we did not have the COVID complications of whether, you know, people are going to be able to travel in May and so on, it's still very heavy on logistics. You know, people come from, besides the local core team, we have people who come from various parts of the world. They have to fly in with relatively heavy equipment, so we need to find airlines that allow them to fly in with this equipment. They have to have accommodation here, transport here, everything set for the diving. But ultimately, if one has a clear plan with regard to what one wants to do and one wants to achieve, I think you look back and it's all worth it. I mean, this year, 2021, we finished the excavation of the 4x2 trench on the Phoenician shipwreck. I mean, I can't believe that four seasons have gone by, and we actually finished what we set out to do. So there is hassle, so to speak, but I think it's all worthwhile. We have a wonderful world down there.
Great. Well, it's lovely to end on such a positive note. We've run out of time. I'd just like to say thank you very much to Professor Timmy Gambine for being with us. And I hope that our listeners will join us again next week when we shall be tackling another important theme in the field of archaeology. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.